We already had a number of nice talks this morning discussing about star formation regulation on galaxy scales. So I thought in my talk I would talk a little bit more about the impact of feedback on the ISM. So I'm mostly going to be talking about sort of galaxy scale simulations. And in terms of what we can compare with the ISM and molecular clouds, we can look at the properties and structure of the ISM, including the amount of gas in different components, cold, warm, and hot ISM. We can look at the scale height, and we can start to sort of to try and make sort of synthetic H1 and CO maps and compare the spatial distribution and the line widths of these with observations. And then molecular clouds themselves, we know that these are obviously turbulent, highly structured, and low star formation efficiency. We can also look at their other properties like the cloud rotations and mass spectra. So we'll be looking at all these properties and how they depend on feedback. So do we need to match these properties? Well, yes, if you don't include feedback, you get very different answers. I think sort of Phil was sort of saying something along these lines in his talk, but mostly you need feedback to sort of counteract gravity. You've got your molecular cloud collapsing to form stars, and you need something to counteract that process. So that's an outline of my talk. I'm going to spend the first part of the talk talking about the properties of molecular clouds and the ISM in disk simulations. I'm going to spend a little bit of time looking at cloud formation and dispersal. And then the later part of my talk is going to be sort of more preliminary results, looking at zoom-in simulations of a section of the disk where you can able to resolve the gas much better, and looking at synthetic CO and H1 maps from these simulations. Mostly I'm going to be talking about isolated galaxy simulations. These are SPH simulations. I just model the gas in them, so the stars, dark matters, are all represented by an external potential. And the external potential includes a spiral component, and I set this to either zero, so no spiral, two or four. So apart from one slide, I don't show you cases without the spiral component. I include a self-gravity of the gas, and cooling and heating of the ISM. So this is very this is basically the same as what Steffi described in her talk. The prescription of Glover and McLaren includes the same heating and cooling processes. It's slightly less sophisticated than the version that Steffi uses, but it's essentially the same processes. H2 and CO formation are included. I'll talk a bit more about those in detail at the end. I've run simulations with 1, 4, and 8 million particles. Most of the simulations are with, or most of the results are with 8 million particles. So that gives sort of mass resolution of each particle mass is about 300 solar masses. And I'd say quite simple stellar feedback prescription. So in no way am I attempting to model all the stellar feedback processes. Rather, I'm just putting in energy in the simulations, which I'm trying to do in different ways to assess how the way you put in energy, whether it matters and what it does. So the stellar feedback, I put it in as usual above a given density, and these are the values I've tried. I've also tried 1,000, but the results here are for 500 particles per centimetre cubed, and it also has to be a converging flow. So I modelled the energy based on a supernova prescription, so using a SEDOV solution for putting in the energy. So then then you distribute the energy as both kinetic and thermal energy. And I put in amount of energy according to this equation, where epsilon is the sort of normal efficiency parameter, and it's times by the amount of molecular gas times 10 to the 51 for the energy of a supernova, and 160 solar masses comes from the IMF and the limits that I've taken. I would say in my calculations, I imagine everyone else's, I would not trust the value of epsilon to less than a factor of two. I'd say that's the sort of uncertainty in both what you've seen for the IMF, just how you've put it in the calculations, whether there's any overcooling. So yeah, I would say there's some uncertainty in that value. I've tried various different values from 1% to 40%. So as Eve and Steffi described, I sort of originally tried doing like high resolution examples just of a SEDOV test. So it's quite easy to show the solution in the adiabatic case, but as Steffi said, if you then go into the momentum driven case, it depends a lot on your cooling, and that damps the energy quite a lot. So although I've kind of described this in terms of supernovae, most of my results I've actually put in the energy instantaneously, so that's not really so representative of supernovae. It's more like winds that might be inserted to the gas instantly. I've also sort of tried putting in energy continuously over a time period, so about 10 mega years. I don't find this makes a big difference to the results. It's more like if you just change your efficiency parameter, you would get the same things. If you sort of perhaps halved it, you would get, or sorry, doubled it, you would get the same thing as if you put it in continuously over time. And I also tried putting in a delay, but I found this didn't work because if you put in a delay, the gas is trying to collapse, and then when you eventually put in the feedback in, it's too gravitationally bound for the feedback to be effective. So I found that didn't work. Oh, that's the mass of molecular gas in the simulation. Oh no, oh sorry. It's so I take particles in a smoothing length, so it's about sort of 1020 parsecs in length. A small cloud, yeah, or part of a massive GMC, yeah. So this is an example simulation. This let's say the M equal two spiral. Gas is going into the spiral arms. In the spiral arms, it's sort of subject to cloud-cloud collisions and also self-gravity, which is creating more massive GMCs, which are the larger sort of yellow objects. This is yellow and blue represents H2, that integrated along the line of sight. This one shows the vertical plane. If it goes back to the beginning of the simulation, it's all sort of all the gases in the plane of the disk, and as feedback occurs, it's sort of puffing the disk up and resulting in molecular gas above and below the plane of the disk. So what results do you get if you vary the feedback? So this is results with three different values. 1% is like very low, and it's really not having very much effect. What you get in this case is the clouds tend, or the gas tends to get very much separated into small bound clouds, which if you look carefully, you can see lots of kind of round clouds along the arms and interarm regions, and then a sort of warmer diffuse phase in between. And these clouds sort of just are unable to be disrupted, a bit like the one Steffi showed in her simulation. If you go to the 5% case, which I generally find is sort of like a best fit match to the observational comparisons, then the clouds are disrupted. You still very clearly see the spiral structure, and you see sort of interarm spurs and features that you'd expect to see in the disk. If you go to high feedback levels, then the feedback starts to sort of dominate the disk and actually sort of disrupting the spiral structure. We can have, look at other properties of the ISM. So this is the velocity dispersion. This shows the for the 5% case, calculated an angle around the galaxy. This is in a 1 kiloparsec annulus at 7 to 8 kiloparsecs. First case, you get a slight increase in the spiral arms, because where you have spiral shocks there. And I actually did find an increase in the velocity dispersion with the feedback efficiency, although I would note that these are fairly extreme cases. So the 1% is sort of like basically no feedback, and 20% is very strong, and it does tend to sort of saturate at levels above about 10% and doesn't show much variation. So the scale height of the disk. This is some comparisons. Again, the scale height increases with the level of feedback. It also varies with radius, I think, due to the gravity of the stellar component. But it sort of agrees roughly with the observations. This is a distribution of how much of the gas is in different phases. So I've got to see how long these will run for. These are run for, well, it looks like about 320 mega years or something. As you put in more feedback, you get lower amounts of coal gas and more warm gas as expected. I've not put in hot gas here. That's sort of about 1% or less of the gas is a very small amount. I would say it's quite hard to generate the best fitting sort of scale height and velocity dispersion, but at the same time still produce quite a lot of cold gas. You tend to, if you put in more feedback, you end up with a quite low amount of cold gas. And then we can look at properties of clouds. This is the mass spectrum for different levels of feedback. Actually, if you put in very low feedback, then you tend to get this bimodal distribution, which is again these massive clouds that can't be disrupted by the feedback. I forgot to say how I found the clouds. I use a sort of a simple clump finding algorithm that, in this case, I think I used a surface density of 100 solar masses per parsec squared to select the clouds, and then I've used values between about 50 and 100, so I think in this case it was 100. You can also look at the virial parameters. So in the 1% case, because these clouds have collapsed and they can't expand, they're all quite strongly bound, whereas in the higher feedback case, in there for 5%, there is both unbound and bound clouds. And we can also look at cloud rotations. There's a poster on this outside. In the low feedback case, or very low feedback, then most clouds are prograde, which is in disagreement with observations. But then if you include more feedback, then it starts to match observations much better. And I think it's just in the 1% case, as I say, all the gas is sort of going into these dense clouds that aren't really interacting with each other. They just go around pretty much in isolation. Can also look at the star formation efficiency of clouds in the simulations. So this is just one cloud and looking at the mass of stars it forms versus time. So I mean, and it doesn't really survive all, it doesn't really exist for anywhere near like 100 mega years. It's more exists in this middle period where it's forming the most stars. So it's not really forming hardly any stars at these early and later periods. But it forms, it turns about 2.5% of its mass into stars. And this, so more generally, the clouds typically turn about 1% of mass into stars, and similar finding in Phil Hopkins' work. And again, we can look at the total star formation rate. So I won't say much about this, but as other people found, this is with different levels of feedback. And I find that if you increase the feedback by sort of factor of four, then it doesn't make it, it has a much lesser effect on the star formation rate. So essentially, it's sort of becoming self-regulating. And like as was pointed out earlier in the week, if you don't include any feedback at all, the points are sort of way above this distribution. I've also done some tests with and without a spiral potential. And I don't find that much difference with and without a spiral potential either. The main difference is that with the spiral, what happens, you tend to get more massive clouds, and that tends to increase the star formation rate slightly. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about like gas flow and gas dynamics in sort of generally, and how this differs for feedback or strong feedback case, and sort of the role of feedback in disrupting GMCs. In recent work, I looked at evolution of one cloud in particular detail. This shows a 40 megayear time period of one cloud as it forms in a spiral arm and disperses. All the different color blocks are different clouds, so you can see that a number of smaller clouds go to form this GMC, whilst the dashed white lines actually show the locus of diffuse gas. So I don't know if you can read the top left of each of the panels, but that tells you how much is in clouds. So actually, 10 megayears, or no, sorry, 20 megayears earlier, most of the gas that goes into that cloud is diffuse gas rather than other clouds. And the process sort of pretty much reverses when you look at the evolution of the clouds. Again, the cloud splits up into a number of smaller clouds and lots of diffuse gas, and after another 20 megayears, it's mostly diffuse gas. So this is a 2 times 10 to the 6 solar mass cloud. In this, or in the previous picture, there's clearly both clouds and diffuse gas going into making the cloud. So I've recently been trying to look at that a bit more quantitatively, and looking at how many cloud collisions are occurring in the disk. And I do that by I take all my clouds, and with SPHI I have a list of particles that are in those clouds. And then I look back at a time 1 megayear earlier and see which of the clouds at the 1 megayear earlier had have the same particles. And if at least two clouds had the same particle, then I identify that as a cloud collision or interaction is probably a better word. And what I find is that I get a frequency of cloud collisions of about 1 every 10 megayears, which is quite high compared with previous sort of theoretical estimates. I actually find that if I use the number density of clouds in the spiral arms rather than the average over the whole disk, which is what is usually used in this sort of analysis, then I get an answer much closer to the estimate that I have from trying to identify cloud interactions. I'd say that this might depend a bit on the definition of the cloud you use and the surface densities to define the cloud. So I'd say it's a bit preliminary as to whether this is a final result. Some other people have tried to do things similar things. Most noticeably, Elizabeth Tasker's work, that she finds slightly lower frequencies of cloud-cloud collisions, but she doesn't have a there wasn't an imposed spiral potential in that model. And we can look at cloud disruption. So clearly, feedback is one of the main things we consider for cloud disruption. But I've also looked at the role of shear, and I think we can tell that shear is important, at least for the sort of the very largest complexes, just from looking at what's happening to these complexes. So we can see that this is being sheared out by the differential rotation of the disk into a sort of large spur-like feature. I mean, this cloud here is slightly unbound, so it can be sheared out, but there are regions within it which are bound, which need feedback to disperse them. Oops. So I looked at sort of a critical density at which shear can disrupt the clouds, and I worked out according to this calculation. And here, so it depends on the size of your cloud, which I took to be quite large. I used the example of the one I showed in the previous slide. And F here is the force due to the underlying potential in the disk. And you can see, like, at quite low galactic radii, it is possible to disrupt a sort of 100 solar mass per particle. Sorry, 100 solar mass per parsec squared clouds. And you can also look at the time scale, where I've just used Oort's constant to calculate the time scale. And this does sort of occur on time scales of about 20 mega years, which is similar to what I showed in the pictures earlier. But as I say, if I replace our cloud at a lower value, then obviously going to get higher, and we'll find that the shear can't disrupt those clouds. And there are certainly bound clouds in the simulation and bound clumps in the simulations where feedback is important. So probably on smaller scales where rather than the size scales of the largest clouds or complexes. This just shows a little bit about looking at the underlying dynamics in different cases. So, in a feedback-dominated regime and one where the spiral arms are still probably the main source of the dynamics. And this was looking at sort of the rate of strain tensor and looking at the eigenvalues from that. So, if you just take the sum of the eigenvalues, it's just the divergence, and that's very simple. If the lambda 1 minus lambda 2 has a name, I don't know what it is, but I sort of thought of this in terms of the asymmetry of the flow. And then if you plot these against each other, then you can see different areas that correspond to different types of dynamics. And you can also look at the scales. So in the feedback-dominated scales case, the time scale for regions to expand or contract in the gas is quite a lot shorter than the spiral arm, than the case where it's dominated by the spiral arms, sort of taking less than a mega year compared to mega year times. You also see in the spiral arms case, there's this sort of tendency of many points along this diagonal line, which corresponds to 1D contraction. So this would be kind of similar to the like converging flows picture, where you've got two parallel converging flows. So in the last 5 minutes, I'll just show some preliminary results from doing higher resolution simulations. So in this case, what I've done is I've taken the global simulation, I've taken a region of gas, I've gone back in time by 50 mega years, and then I've split the particles, so I've split them into, in this case, I've split them into 81. I also selected any other particle that was in that sort of region or any boundary particles, and that constituted about a quarter of the total particles. And by doing this, I got to a mass per particle of under 4 solar masses. And by putting in feedback and things, I now is at the resolution where I could put in feedback on a parsec scale. This is not quite the resolution that Ian Bunnell obtained, but unlike these simulations meant here, this does still include stellar feedback. So yeah, this is the same time in the global simulation and the resimulation. So although this is much higher resolution, the structure isn't massively different. So this is, I'm afraid it's not in the rotating frame, it's just the movie of the gas flowing into the spiral arm. So unfortunately it goes across the box. But you can see sort of in the more in the interim regions, you can see sort of feedback going on in the gas, and as I show in a minute, sort of strong filamentary structure. So again, I've compared like different putting in different amounts of feedback and different prescriptions. But I actually found in these higher resolution cases, not a great deal of difference, at least in the sort of XY dimension of the disk between the different amounts of feedback. You can see slightly more clearly sort of regions where you've got hot gas and very low densities in the high feedback case. And compared with the global simulations before, I see you can see sort of hot gas. I'll show you this a bit more in a minute. Okay. And filaments much more easily. So certainly these filaments here are much thinner, better resolved than in the global case. This one here is about 10 parsecs wide, and they're several hundreds of parsecs long. You can also see in here, I've just highlighted where some sort of some feedback event has occurred and some blown out hole in the filament and it's disrupting them. And I say, again, I've tried to put in like a feedback over time and a stochastic implementation so that rather than feedback going off everywhere, it just goes off in sort of one in, well, I put it off in 1 in 10 cases, but then put in 10 times the amount of energy. And I wouldn't say completely rule out that these change things dramatically, but so far I've not found any particular big difference on the results presented here. I do find more difference if I look in the vertical direction. So with the higher feedback case, you can kind of see that the shells that are being created are sort of being, hot gas is escaping from them, sort of being blown apart. But in the low feedback cases, you can see that they're more or less intact. And it does also seem to make more of a difference of the amount of hot gas there is and the amount of hot gas sort of you can see above and below the plane of the disk. And generally, these zoom-in calculations are more successful at resolving hot gas. And just cloud properties as well. So the difference here is that before I could only look at like this part of the plot, whereas now I can resolve clouds at about like 400 or 500 solar masses. But I don't really get particularly different results. It's just that as I go to lower masses, there's more scatter compared with the more massive clouds. And for in terms of the cloud rotations as well, I get very similar results and sort of a very similar fraction of retrograde clouds. Well, I don't know how much this is just to do with it's still taking into account the initial conditions. So I'll just say, sorry, this just my time. We have been doing stuff on comparison with H1 and CO, as Karen suggested yesterday, looking at holes. So I'll just say that we kind of found a similar distribution, but I don't know how sort of how good things like whole radii are as a test of how well the feedback's doing. It seems to be, or how robust, as most holes tend to be sort of similar size regardless of the simulation or the galaxy. But we did find, by looking at KS tests and things, difficulties in comparing holes if you've got highly inclined galaxies or fairly low resolution. So we have been looking at CO. This is just the equations that we use to model H2 and CO. That's to show that it works. And these are sort of comparisons of the outer galaxy in H1 CO. And the main result here was that we found sort of reasonable agreement. We found that changing sort of parameters in the chemistry made very little difference. How we did the self-shielding, how we changed the chemistry when we put in feedback, there was much bigger differences whether or not you included feedback and on your overall the surface density of the gas. So I'll just leave up my conclusions.
Time for a few questions. Anyone? Chris?
Yeah, I have a comment and a question. So the comment is that you're really interested here, sort of more than in the previous talk, on the evolution and effective feedback on scale, molecular cloud scales, where the really relevant feedback mechanism is not the one that you've included. It's instead what Ant Whitworth pointed out in 79, which is that the photoionization from massive stars acts across ionization fronts to photoevaporate material. And as I pointed out in 2002, that injects a fair amount of momentum into the dense molecular gas. So it acts completely differently from the supernova feedback prescription that you've implemented. So I'd be very interested to find out whether a change of the character of feedback has more of a qualitative effect than the change in the efficiency with which the supernova feedback is implemented. The question I had is about the filamentary structure. The filamentary structure that you have in the current model seems to be a product of the shear of the galaxy. And one of the features of the clouds is that they're living for longer than the shear time scale. And so you get a significant amount of shearing in the clouds. If the other forms of feedback were implemented, they probably wouldn't live so long. So you might not have as much of a correlation between the filaments and the galactic shear direction. So I'm wondering if we have data on the correlation between filamentary structures within clouds and the direction of the galactic shear.
There's a few papers on filaments. So these are quite unusual ones because they're sort of 100 or more parsecs long. So there are a couple of papers, there's one by Sarah Reagan. I don't know that they've looked at the direct comparison with the differential.
Definitely, the very longest filaments are correlated with the galactic plane, for no doubt about that. I'm talking about the internal structures of the clouds.
Yeah. At some stage, you show this interesting table where you modify, where you vary the efficiency of your feedback and gives the sigma, the versus pen. It was sort of scaling like the square root, the relation between the two. When you changed sigma by a factor, epsilon by a factor 20, you get variations for sigma by a factor something like 4 from the top of my memory. If you write down the energy budget, saying that the dissipation of turbulence has to be compensated by this source of momentum, and if H is constant and you expect cubic, that sigma scale like epsilon to the 1/3, if the scale height of the disk is modified, then that could also modify this a bit. So I was wondering whether you treat to compare these trends with some simple analytical modeling from which we could learn a lot on how turbulence dissipate and whether the simple laws that we are writing are justified or not. So have you compared that with some analytical modeling?
I think Andy Burkett did something like this when I was working with him, and I think he did find quite a good agreement.
Okay.
I don't think he did anything with it.
Okay, thank you.
Claire, I was wondering if you do you set up anything like a galactic wind? Can you measure the mass flux through the upper boundary of your simulation? And how much does that depend on the star formation efficiency and other parameters?
I haven't really done that in the global simulations. It's not really very well resolved, the hot gas and above and below the plane. I think in the zoom-in simulations it is, but I just haven't looked at that yet.
Any other final comments? Thank you very much, Claire. So we're now going to go on to discussion of this morning's session, and why don't you take a deep breath, stretch for a minute, and just get your thinking caps on about what we saw this morning. I'm going to just one microphone will be down this side of the audience, and this one will be over
So I guess maybe I'll direct this to Eve initially. We saw this very nice analytic theory for the star formation rate. And one thing that I didn't notice was any dependence on galactic rotation, things like shear, epicyclic frequency, and so forth. Yet it seems when we look at galaxies that galaxies that are slow rotators, some of these dwarf galaxies, can actually get very extreme star formation events, things like 30 Doradus and so forth, which big galaxies might not. It seems plausible that the size of these giant H2 regions could be affected by tidal forces or by rotational shear and so forth. So I want to get your comments on that and whether that is something that somehow should be included in the theory.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. So one of the things, I mean, the very simplest version assumes planar symmetry. And of course, if you have low rotation, then Q becomes small and you can collapse and you no longer preserve that planar symmetry. So it's kind of a prerequisite for applying this that Q is not so low that the region is actually has a large scale gravitational instability. So, you know, it's still, as I kind of referred to, you can still apply this in a general way to non-planar regions. It's just then you have to actually include information about how the efficiency per free fall time depends on the turbulent properties.
Okay, I think
Go to Mark.
So I wanted to ask about something else that I think has not been included in any of the models that we didn't hear anything about, and it's sort of unfortunate we don't have any of the observers who worked on this here, which is the dependence on metallicity. So in the Small Magellanic Cloud, we see very clearly that the star formation law, at least in a spatially resolved sense, that the galaxy follows, is not the same as is followed by higher metallicity galaxies. We know that DLAs and sub-DLA and the outskirts of Lyman Break galaxies, observationally, do not fall on the same Kennicott-Schmidt law as higher metallicity systems. So I'm wondering what the prospects are in any of the feedback-regulated models of any of the flavors we've seen for either attempting to reproduce or even comparing with those observations, because they have thus far been completely absent from the discussions.
Talk about data, anyone?
So I'm just wondering, when you're talking about the star formation law, you're talking about total gas star formation law? Because the SMC, at least, seems to behave relatively well with just H2.
Yeah, that's exactly what I meant. So the SMC has the same star formation law in the H2, but a very different total gas star formation law. And one of the difficulties is that in the feedback-regulated models, all of these models get the star formation rate by balancing the weight of the ISM against some form of feedback. And it seems difficult to explain that observation in that context because, of course, the weight of the ISM doesn't care about whether the atoms are locked in molecules or not.
So, Mark, I'll comment that, you know, if we had any, I guess, do we have here who might be from the, who's looked at that? So I know Alberto would tell you that we don't really know the orientation of the SMC, so we don't actually know the surface density very well at all.
For the DLAs, and I mean, for the DLAs, we know that
absolutely. At high redshift, do you think you know their orientation?
No, but we know their surface densities. That we know perfectly well. All of them? There are hundreds. They're all edge on?
I think that what
we
really like is
to actually look at the effects of metallicity. I think what we need is something where we have really a good handle on what the true surface density is in order to make those comparisons. Where we don't have it, I think it's quite difficult.
I wonder if, I thought I'd take just 1 minute to maybe, as chair, to try to step back from all the detail that we've seen this morning. And I thought maybe a way of organizing what we talked about, it just suggested here, just to toss this out maybe for more general discussion. You know, we wanted to know what star formation ideas we need to build reliable galactic models. And there's an entire list of candidates here that have been discussed in this meeting so far. This list probably continues. The basic underlying thought here is that, you know, we're looking for something, some general principle that's highly reliable based on physics. But, you know, thermodynamics gets us into the macroscopic world very well. We don't need to go all the way down to the level of the quarks. So what are the quarks in this basic field that we're dealing with? What can we ignore? I don't think we're there yet, but that is basically the question of what circle do I draw around these processes that will matter in understanding how galaxies are put together. So we've had a lot of discussion here about the IMF. GMCs have loomed very large on both these questions. And just at this level here of structure, filaments that have come up in many of the simulations, here's a calculation from Dale Bunnell, in which you see photoionization from this highly filamentary GMC-type region doesn't have much effect on feeding back on the dense gas streams that are flowing in to the cluster region here. The photoionization gas leaks into these voids created by the collapse in the filaments. Doesn't seem to have such a huge effect. The other question I think that's come up in the discussion is, what do galaxies do to, what do we need to know about galaxy dynamics to reliably build star formation pictures? And we've just had a couple of talks about that as well. Galactic dynamics, many aspects have been discussed in this meeting, including cosmological context, cold flows, etc. Massive black holes, AGN activity, instabilities as an example have come up. I'm just going to put a picture from some of our own work. Samantha Benincasa, a former undergraduate thesis student with me in our group here, in a co-rotating frame put in this galactic simulation where tumor instability is breaking this up into filamentary type of clouds. Zooming in on our co-rotation torus here, you can see highly filamentary clouds interacting with one another, the shear and cloud interaction, which is pulling out filamentary structure, which dominates the structure of giant molecular clouds from Herbert Herschel observations. So once again, the effect of galactic dynamics upon building clouds is very present in this whole subject. So as well as just kind of summarizing remarks, I thought maybe people want to jump in and pick away at aspects of this.
I thought I might say something about quarks.
Good.
So there's a range of feedback mechanisms, and they don't each extend up to the scale of galaxies. So I think we've had many talks where the range, you know, was limited to the few events that are appropriate on the scale of the large scale effects that you're looking at. I just wanted to mention that there is this very broad distribution in of look down in the scale of a protocluster region. You have a very broad distribution of forces because of the collimation of outflows. You have a very broad distribution of H2 regions and of star clusters that can create both supernova remnants and superbubbles. And as a result of that, that benefits people working on the very largest scales, because that means that the things that can really puff up the galaxy and set the scale height are the momentum injection events that will not collide and cancel, as Yoke pointed out yesterday or the day before, on much smaller scales. Nevertheless, the smaller scale feedbacks allow those larger scale momentum vectors to develop, and that's something that's been very well shown in the fire simulations.
Other thoughts? Yes, please. Yeah. There's a microphone that could be on this side that should be handed back there. Where did it go?
I wanted to come back, sorry, to the first talk from Eve about the IR radiation experiment that you did. So, I mean, what I took from it is that it's a bit disappointing. It doesn't work. It's not a very strong effect on this type of cloud that you've studied. And I was wondering, since from the galaxy formation perspective, we do need those very strong feedback events, maybe only in very extreme environments such as starbursts or very high redshift galaxies. Would it be possible to redo this experiment in a much extreme kind of cloud setup? And what are the technical challenges? I mean, because it's easy to say, but there are some issues, I guess. And so maybe that's something we could do during this program, to try to set up this ARP 220 type of, or even high redshift kind of clump setup. And then, I mean, from what you know already from this work, does it make sense to try that?
Yeah, I think that's potentially a very interesting idea. I mean, also Christine was saying that maybe the opacities really are larger than we think in more extreme systems like ARP 220. So that would certainly help. I think the main point is that it's really the potential well depth which tells you how much feedback you get. So if you can arrange to get a deeper potential well, as for example Alex Diamond-Stanek talked about in some very high redshift systems, this may end up giving you much stronger feedback.
Thanks, Eve. So I wanted to follow up actually on a question that I asked at the end of my own talk, which is what are the prospects for observationally measuring the turbulent gas velocity dispersions in extreme systems like QLERGS, or alternatively reliably measuring the tumor EQ parameter in those systems, because I think that's a limit in which our implementation of this feedback regulated model slightly differs from EVE.
I'm sure Kristen also could answer that question, but I mean, it's going to be HST resolution with ALMA, and so the EULERs will be very easy, and the SMG high redshift galaxies will also be scale proportionally quite easily. So certainly the EULORs, the local EULORs, will be very easy. I mean, there are some numbers already, but one can debate whether or not they're good numbers. But certainly with ALMA, it will be very easy. In fact, Kristen probably can do that, start doing that with her data now with ARP220.
So what do we know from the existing numbers that you are referring to?
The actual number.
Well, all I say specifically are the turbulent gas velocity dispersions in EULORs of order 10 kilometers per second, or the significantly elevated relative to
that? Well, there's certainly more than 10 kilometers per second. I don't remember offhand the exact number, but right, it's shearing.
Yeah, please.
I think that an issue is that it's hard to take out the large scale shear, as well as the non-circular flows, and that's given that it's unless you can actually get in there and resolve on scales less than what you think. If it's not a disk system, then it's all kind of moot anyway. But if it is, then you want to resolve on a scale which is less than what you believe is the disk scale height. That's hard.
So I think we haven't done the number yet in our ARP-T20 data, but I think we will be able to try to do this. I was thinking about the CO data and looking, if we look along the minor axis, then then we won't have so much rotation spreading, and we have some ideas of the inclination from the continuum size. But I don't have a number for you. I'm sure it's more than 10, because in more quiescent galaxies you see numbers like 10. And in fact, in M51. The velocity dispersion is getting up towards 20, and we have that in a paper from a few years ago from the JCMT Legacy Survey. So, but I am going to be looking at this number when we go
back. So, in the a lot of that there can be very strong local shear from spiral structure, and that's certainly contributing in M51. We looked at that in detail.
Yes.
Just coming back to this picture, I was wondering how do the sizes of these clouds depend on the mass of the galaxy? Is there a dependence also of these giant molecular clouds which you form on a dependence on the mass of the galaxy?
In these simulations, this is a typical L-star galaxy here. We haven't run other models in this study, but Elizabeth Tasker, I think, at the moment is working away on
I had another question. I'm a total ignorant about the whole subject of this workshop. I just am here to learn something, but I hear everybody talking about the formation of disks, but in our galaxy we also have a system of the halo with all the globular clusters. Where do they come from this picture?
Someone want to pick that up? Globular clusters, where do they rise? Please. The microphone. There's one up, yeah.
I'm definitely not an expert, but what I remember is that the most successful model so far is that they form in the disks and then they are redistributed to the halo during the mergers that happen at earlier times. It's still a very open question as far as I know, but that's the model that seems to be favored so far. Yeah, it's all of those mergers, the ones that redistribute the clusters.
Right, you don't have to have a stable disk before redshift 2, so at that time things are more chaotic. There's more smaller systems coming in and with carrying dense gas with them, and potentially having to very efficiently convert all their stars into gas, forming the massive star clusters.
I thought one interesting point that came up in today's talk is this idea of building equilibrium models for the interstellar media, which seem to be quite successful, yet at the same time we know that there's highly bursty activity. So one of the points here in building a more thermodynamic picture, if you will, is this issue of are we at equilibrium or could we be far from equilibrium? Anyone want to pick that up? Just way back there.
Sorry. Yeah, that's one point I'm missing, for instance. If we, for instance, tried always to figure out what are the recipes to in equilibrium disks, we neglect that the disk is, for instance, fed by infall. And obviously, that is the case in dwarf galaxies. We have these starburst dwarf galaxies, which obviously are surrounded by a reservoir of gas that falls in and obviously triggers the starburst, and then the IMF also changes. And I think that's a very important point, not to, to try to balance and to find an equilibrium situation for our galaxy with some parameter fine-tuning, but also to take the environment into account.
Any other burning questions?
I had a question for the theorist. There's also the issue of the extended UV disk in galaxies, where it's pretty well known that, you know, they have a fairly high star formation rate for their surface density of gas. So it's sort of, it's along the line, the same line as what Mark was saying, sort of stretching the Schmidt-Kennicott law and see if it applies to also, if the models can explain the lower limit of the Schmidt-Kennicott law. So I was wondering if any of these models can be extended to those lower density, and is there a way, because the actual slope changes as you go to lower, it seems to change for the extended UV disk, and you know, that might be a way to discriminate between those various way of forming stars.
Some work in that direction, and she. But I guess my summary of that would be that, so the particular model that I describe is one that really made a number of simplifications that we believe are valid at the high gas surface density limit. But when you go to lower gas surface densities, you may have metallicity effects like Mark highlighted, but also different feedback processes can operate, and perhaps different processes that can also excite the turbulence. The situation is significantly more complicated. And I suspect that more sophisticated model that includes element of feedback would be relevant there, but it's simply I think it's a more complicated regime, which, like I said, Eve has made some progress in.
The one additional comment I would make is that often the outer disk star formation is quite concentrated in spiral arms, so you know, these extended UV disks are often quite concentrated in arms, and so the kind of local models are not so appropriate for that, because if you talk about a disk an azimuthal average, that those conditions are not really the same as you would get once you've compressed gas in what amounts to a spiral wave.
On a similar note, I wanted to ask, I understood maybe 10 years ago that there was an excess of turbulent motions in the H1 disks far outside the star formation edges of galaxies, and I'm wondering if that has an obvious explanation. Excess as in significant turbulent velocities that are not being steered locally by star formation.
Just behind you.
Well, in regards to that point, I know that some of the papers that have been looking at, you know, resolved stellar populations in dwarf galaxies, which isn't exactly the same thing, but maybe close, can't explain, based on the energy input that they predict from star formation histories, the turbulent velocities in H1 below star formation rates of something like, or star formation rate surface densities of about 10 to the minus 3. So. At very low star formation rate surface densities, when there's a lot of H1 velocity dispersion, something else has to be contributing that's not just star formation.
Yes.
The thermal line width of 10 to the 4 K gas is also of order 10 kilometers per second. So it's difficult to determine whether these line widths really are turbulent, especially if you're dominated by warm neutral medium. which, you know, in a filling factor sense, you could be in these outer disks.
My point was similar, actually, for about the outer disks. I thought about this a long time ago, and then the point I made then was that the star formation is located where the surface density is high enough to have shielding from UV radiation, and you go cold. And that model at the same time also accounted for the fact that the velocity dispersions were similar to those of the warm neutral medium. The default state there of the gas is warm, atomic. So you need to have an excess surface density, for example, from spiral arms to be able to go cold, to shield.
Can I back up to something you asked about here?
Please.
So it seems to me, since the emphasis is not on resolving the physics, but just going as far as need be to get the recipes correct, that magnetic fields, including magnetic fields, isn't going to be important. And I wonder what other people think about that.
Great, I'm glad somebody asked the B question. So, lots of hands. Great, let's start here.
I can answer because we have performed a simulation at a kiloparsec scale, similar to what Eva has been presented with the magnetic field. What we found generally is kind of consistent with what people have been finding on smaller scales. It tends to reduce the star formation rate by a factor of, say, 2 typically, and also it tends to have a disk which is less fragmented, in a sense that the number of clouds drops by typically a factor 2 as well, essentially because the flow is more coherent, because it's more difficult. There is a surface tension associated to that. So that's typically of the order of 2 at the very large scales for the galactic disks. Of course, it's much more important at small scale when you collapse and so on. The byproduct of star formations heavily depend on that. But on large scales, something like a factor 2, I would say, for those problems.
Other comment about B anywhere? Way back there.
So regarding the magnetic field, I'd say one place where it potentially is very significant is with respect to getting the right amount of feedback from at least certain mechanisms. And I'd say the one example of that is the work that Wang and Abel did, showing that protostellar outflow feedback is dramatically more effective in the presence of a magnetic field than without it. And I've done some work showing that ionization feedback is much more effective in the presence of a magnetic field than without it. Basically because magnetic fields are an efficient mechanism of transferring momentum around the cloud, so you lose much less of it. So you've got Dale and Donnell up there. It is not clear that you would get the same results if you had a magnetic field. And so it may not be important for doing the galaxy scale simulations, but it is certainly important for getting the right subgrid, if you wanted to get the subgrid recipes in the galaxy simulations from first principles and not just tune them until everything sort of works, then you do need magnetic fields.
So we'll call B not a quark, and we'll go to lunch. Thank you very much.